Greetings, Earthlings. Welcome to ADX Files. I'm your host, Alison Dunlop-Shanes, and thank you for joining me on this Paranormal Panorama Network show. Paul Askoff has spent over 50 years involved in UFO research and investigation. He has his own UFO sighting and was a member of the British UFO Research Association, otherwise known as BUFORA. He's been on numerous podcasts and featured in two documentaries by EM Productions, which were released last year. He's also appeared as a guest speaker at the Outer Limits magazine annual conference. Most recently, he has released a book with Philip Mantle's Flying Disc Press about UFOs. And Paul gives a new slant on the subject, looking at the bigger picture and discussing the complex relationship between UFOs and the paranormal. Welcome to ADX Files, Paul. I'm so glad that you could join me on the show this month.
Thank you for having me, Alison. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, I want to start by hearing about you. What's your background story?
Well, career-wise, I've been medical all my life, but as a child, I was an avid reader. I was one of these kids that grew up reading books, which my father sort of pushed, though I was never read anything like science fiction and UFOs. I mean, I'm 66 now, so there was no such thing back in the day then when I was like 8, 9, 10 years old. And then in 1968, when I was just 11, I just had a few weeks after my 11th birthday, I had my first UFO sighting, my first UFO encounter. And that's sort of what got me into it, because at the time it was so odd, so bizarre. And again, if you'll forgive the pun, it was so alien that it was obvious that it wasn't terrestrial, it wasn't from here. And it was like from that moment on, I wanted to know the nuts and bolts, how something could work. How did it appear like that to us? Why did we see and why do we experience what we do? And that sort of got me into it, and I've just followed it ever since.
So you start off your introduction in your book with many words of wisdom and what seems to be a firm belief in reincarnation. So how did you come to this conclusion?
Well, now that's a good question, because I was brought up quite strict religiously, really. I mean, my father, he wasn't cruel by any means, but he ruled with a rod of iron, and what he said went. So we had to go to church. And initially, I was dedicated a Methodist. I was then brought up Church of England. We had to go to Bible classes. We had to do studies and all this. We had to join the choir. And then when I was just before my 11th birthday, we moved into another home, which was literally 50 yards from the local spiritualist church, of which one or two of my father's colleagues used to go. So they said, come on and try it, and that was it. So we got sucked into that. And as a child, you just go where your parents go. So that was it. Every Sunday, every, you know, high days, holidays, and births, deaths, funerals, and christenings, we went to the spiritualist church. So I've actually been dedicated a Methodist, baptized Church of England, and named a spiritualist.
Wow. That's a collection, isn't it?
Right collection. But the thing is, I think it, because I wasn't steered down one path, it like opens your mind up to other possibilities. And throughout my book, what I do is try and give little, anecdotal experiences that sort of, in a way, I don't believe there's any such thing as coincidence. Everything happens for a reason. And these little experiences like sort of blow your mind and say, well, this definitely isn't normal. Why is this happening, and how can this happen? And that was the hook that got me into UFOs and the paranormal, of why things appear and why we experience what we do.
Now, you said that you believe that God is a collection of pure and powerful souls. Why do you think that?
Because religion, this is all my opinion, but I'm a Yorkshireman, so I think I'm right. But religion is completely man-made. God never wrote anything down. Allah never wrote anything down. Jesus never wrote anything down. It's all what people, you know, Buddha, it's all these religions, Hindu, Jewish, whatever, they're all man's interpretation of what they think. And to me, if you think about it, when Christianity started, Jesus wasn't a Christian. But when Christianity started, you have to think that it was a movement that was growing, and the Romans, as they were in decline. And that is why they sort of took it on board as a way, if you like, it was a business thing to fill their coffers. And if you take a step back and just take the religious connotations out of it and look at it purely as a business model, it worked wonderfully. And because they got the, dare I say, the higher, the top of the hierarchy, like the King of Spain or all these others, on board, then everybody else just followed. It was follow my leader. And that is why Roman Catholicism was as strong as it was in Europe, and then in the New World, in America and South America especially. And I think there's, I mean, the other side of the coin is, yes, you do get good and bad in all religions, and it's a personal thing. But the thing is that it's everything is by your own effort. And it's your morals and your ethics that allow you to move forward, if you like, and raise your vibration and move forward spiritually. It's not about how much you put into the coffers of a church or a synagogue or a mosque or whatever. It's about how you conduct yourself and how you, what can I say, react to other people and help them. And by doing so, you're helping yourself as well.
Okay. So, but how did you come to this conclusion that God was, you said pure and powerful souls, plural.
Yes.
Why plural?
Because I think, as one of the analogies that I give in my book is the old LP, the old vinyl record. And if purity is the hole in the center, which some people call God, mm-hmm. and the outer edge, for want of a better term, is evil. People move, those grooves are all separate lives and separate lessons and separate opportunities that we all have to better ourselves and move towards the center. And I think that's a universal constant. Whatever race you are, as a ufologist, we're always being told that there are different races visiting us. And I think it's universal. Whatever race you are, however high up the ladder you are, however far advanced or not, as the case may be, whatever your station in life is, it's by your effort that you have to improve yourself and move towards the center. You have to do it by your efforts. And that is why nobody can remember, we have this, what can I say, always this argument, if you like, of, is the life after death? Now, as spiritualists, we obviously do believe and we do get confirmation of friends and loved ones coming back and being pointed in the right direction. And we get this throughout the field of paranormal, as well as ufologists, and even just people living the life where you get these synchronicities, where these so-called coincidences happen. And there's no such thing as coincidence. Everything happens for a reason. And it's like when one door closes, it's meant to close and another one will open. You will move to the right place. We're all in the right place where we need to be right now. And there's no, if only I'd done this or if only, there's none of that. What happened had to have happened. And that is why we experience what we do. And that's part of the learning and growing process that we all have to go through. And I just think that with my background as it was, and I kept thinking, well, that can't be right, or this can't be right. And it's like one of the things that my sister said. She said, well, Jesus said the only way to God is through me. And I said, yes, that's a perfect example of how it's been misconstrued. Jesus, that you could argue, was an example of the perfect spiritual person. So he realistically meant you have to improve your thoughts and mind your thoughts to improve as I have. But people took it as a religion, like we, and this worship comes into it then, which again I believe is wrong. And it's Jesus was there as an example, and I think again, coming back now, he would be appalled that people have taken it on as a religion when it should in reality be, this is what you should become. I am here to show you how you can behave and what you can achieve. And I think this is where the message was misconstrued and lost and then misused, if you like, by the Roman Catholic Church. Now, I realise I'm treading on people's toes here, don't get me wrong, but trying to look at things logically. I have mild Asperger's, so I'm a very logical person. And I think anybody with any sort of any logic to look, to be able to stand back and look at things and not be swayed, and to look at the evidence of that as a bigger picture, that is the way we should be doing things.
Have you had personal experiences with God?
That's a good question, and I would say we all you see, this is another thing where people say God will steer you in the right direction and do things like that, and I think it, to an extent, yes, that happens all the time, and it's where different things happen in your life and you meet different people and you are steered in a certain direction. And I think it's this pure energy, because everything is energy. I'm sort of slightly sidetracking here, Alison, but
that's okay. That's all right. Carry on.
Everything is energy, and it's like it can't be destroyed. You know, it moves to something else. And you and I have our own energy. We have our own aura, and that's what reacts to the energy of the room around us, the magnetic field, if you want to call it that. And that is where I believe we all react to the environment that we're in. So obviously, if you're a negative person, you get more negative energy coming towards you. That's why we should always try and be positive and be happy and have the positive outlook on things, because that is what will come back to you, where the negative side of things obviously can come back and bite you in the bum, so to speak. But to say I've spoken to God, I think is, what can I say? Again, that has religious connotations, where I think we've all spoken to God, but it's not as obvious or as cut and dried as people make it out to be. And I think we all have these deja vu moments, and we all have these moments of enlightenment where things come together and everything comes together for a reason. Things happen at certain times in our lives to push us in the right direction.
So you said there, you know, bad, you know, evil, you believe in evil. Have you experiences with evil?
No, this is something else. No, I haven't. Well, having said that, you see, things can be misinterpreted. I gave one instance in my book when I'm quite sure I came across a poltergeist. And I was quite just in, you could say, the right place at the right time. But if I may just reiterate the story, I was in my, I don't know if it was my final year at school. I'd have been 14 to 15 year old. And we were on a trip with school, and we'd been, and it was called the Three Countries Tour. We went to Holland, Belgium, and Germany. So we, like kids do on these old school buses, and off we went. And we stayed in some student accommodation in a little village up near the three borders called Valkenburg. And we went round the caves where they sheltered during the war, and also very sort of historically interesting. But the accommodation we were in was, if you can imagine, like a block of flats. And it could have been five, it could have been six stories tall, but there was no lift. So because of that, it was just used as student accommodation. So you can imagine it was very basic, a big open staircase in the middle. There was a toilet at one side on each landing, and then there were two dormitories, and then a small room, like for a teacher or whoever, at the other opposite the toilet, the other end. So these dormitories had maybe six or eight beds in, something like that. So the men had been one, the women in all, the boys in one, the girls in another. And on the last night, the girls have been carrying on saying there's something in our room and it's scaring us and there's this knocking. So again, typical, I didn't know at the time, but typical knocking sounds. So the all the guys are saying, oh, go on, Paul, you can go sort them out. So I walk to the door of the girls' sort of dormitory, and it's quite a larger room, probably, I don't know, 20 foot by 40, 50 foot even, with these bunk beds and a little cabinet at the side to put the clothes in and the bits. And the girls were all there, all looking terrified, looking at me. So I said, what's the matter? And they're saying, there's this knocking outside. Now, we were on the top floor, so there were no trees, there were no electricity wires, there was nothing that high up. We were literally, it's like a block of flats stuck up out the top of everything. So I'm thinking, very skeptical, thinking, oh yeah, come on. If anything, it's going to be some, it's an old block of flats. It's going to be like mice in the walls or something like that. And as I'm thinking this, and I'm just going to open my mouth and poo-poo the idea, when there's this knock on the far wall, as I'm stood at the doorway, I'm looking to the back, and there was one window on the far wall, and then two down the side wall to my left. And as I'm looking at this window, there's a knock, and it was just like somebody was knocking very hard on the wall with the knuckles. And straight away it was like, whoa, this isn't mice or rats or anything else. And it was like, this is very odd. And I was going to move forward to have a look out the window. Now, this was nighttime by then, so it had got dark. And as I went to move, the knock moved along the wall towards the corner of the building at the other side of the window. And it was just like, if you can imagine, we were like 5 or 6 floors up, and it was just like we were on the ground floor and somebody was walking around the outside of the building, rapping really hard with the knuckles on the wall, which again was an impossibility, but you don't think like that then. And I'm thinking, this is very strange. And then I'm stood still right next to the door. Then rapping then went carried on again down the outside wall to my left, towards the first window, then again in the middle, then again almost directly to my left on the wall at the side of the other window. Then there was silence. The girls had all pulled the covers up round the necks, all looking at each other and looking at me with the eyes wide open. And then on the landing, the toilet had one window in it, and it was one of those with a hinge at the top that you pushed out on like a metal bar. So of course the window had been open, and it was like the bar had been knocked off and the window slammed shut. So I'm looking there, the toilet door was open, there was nothing there. And as I looked back into the room, at the side of me, I'm looking at the girls, nobody said anything. And as I looked back into the room, at the side of me, where the door opened, right at the side of it was positioned a light switch with like a little plastic knob in it, one of these almost like a Baker light thing. And as I'm looking at the girls, this knob physically went up on its own and the lights went off.
No. So
my hair stood on end. All the girls screamed and put the head under the covers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I think it was a pure reaction. I turned the switch back on. Now, some of you that investigate the paranormal might get this, but it was like as soon as I turned the switch back on, it had gone. Where you got that feeling that there was a presence, that there was something there. And I cannot claim to be mediumistic in any way, but you got the feeling that there was something there, that there was a presence. And as soon as I physically turned the light switch back on and took one step forward to do so, it was like the air cleared and there was nothing there. And the girls were like screaming and crying and carrying on, and it was like, okay. And it's like you can't say it's gone, you know. That's just what I felt. And we just got a teacher, and the teacher went and stayed in their room, and there was nothing else happened. But from a, I'm not going to say a disbeliever, but from a skeptical point of view, it was quite bizarre. And I wish that something like that could have been on video, because it was quite light, because the light was on in the room and the light was on the landing. But it was physically something that happened around us that would have been brilliant to have recorded.
That is scary biscuits, that one. That really is. That really, really is. And it's not the only thing that you've experienced either. You saw a man down a mine.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
What happened there?
Now, you see, that wasn't scary at all. And what happened, I worked for a while. I was an occupational health nurse, but as anybody who's in occupational health with industry at the time may know, it can get quite boring. So especially with the mining industry, it was always like chapped fingers and cuts and bruises and things like that, or it was really serious. It was always one extreme or the other. And you got quite bored, sat there waiting for things to happen. And the only time you treated people when the mines finished the shift and they used to come into you and to say, oh, look, I've just done this. And a lot of them are quite strong, big lads. And it was like, you know, I've nearly taken the end of my thumb off. Can you do anything with this type of thing? So I asked to go underground and they put me out with a road laying team. Well, anybody that's worked in a mine, there's a way that the air circulates and they have these big fans that draw the air around the mine to keep gases very low and to keep fresh air circulating so that they don't have any problems. So we were working on the return side where the air had been all the way in around the face and was on its way back out. So it's quite warm. So we'd been road laying like railway track in the return, which was quite warm. So what we used to do was in the mines in those days in Yorkshire, when you had a break, everything stopped. Everybody had the break at the same time. The belts, conveyor belts used to be turned off. Everybody had a break, then the conveyor belts were turned back on and everybody started working again. So everybody had the same amount of time. But what we used to do was when we got to that time, we used to walk out to the intake side where the fresh air was coming in to have a break and have a cooler and have a breather and sit with, they were usually the older and more disabled miners that were put on buttons. Now the button boys were where one conveyor belt would be loading coal onto another conveyor belt, onto these transfer points. So they always had to have somebody there to make sure there were no problems where the conveyor belts were loading the coal from one onto another. So I walked out and I'm sat with this old guy called Roger, and I'm sure he's long gone now, but bless him, he was a nice guy. And we just sat there having a sandwich, nothing happening. I mean, you can imagine, deathly quiet, there's no noise because there's nothing happening. And all the belts are still, and if you turned your lamp off, it was completely black. There's no light. You couldn't see your hand in front of your face. So we just had our lamps on, and there were lights above the transfer point where to enable whoever was on that point to look and make sure that there was no big pieces of coal getting stuck. Next to it was an old heading for some old works, maybe only, I don't know, 34. By 20 foot in an old arched roadway, and it was usually painted white, and that's where the transformers, the electrical transformers, were for the district that it supplied. So you'd have these huge transformers that weighed about five and a half tons and put out something like 11,000 volts. So you have these big thick electrical cables that came out of it. Anyway, we're sat at the side, maybe only 20 yards away from where this was. And coming towards us, we sat there having a sandwich in the silence. And coming towards us was this old deputy who came uphill from the drift where the main conveyor belt came out the mine. They used to call it the M1 because it was a big belt. That comes out, very long belt, and he's walking up at the side of the belt like he's inspecting the roof and coming towards us. He never said any word, never acknowledged us, never anything like that. But he was dressed in old miners' clothes. Now, in those days, I'm talking sort of the early 80s, the National Coal Board for England, we all had bright orange overalls. But a lot of the old deputies and the older men still used to wear the old compressed card caps and the helmets, if you like, and their own clothes and waistcoats and stuff like that. So we didn't think anything more about it. It was just an old deputy inspecting. And then he moved under where the belt transferred from one to the other and into this heading where we couldn't see where the big transformers were. So we waited there and it was like 2 minutes later and he still hadn't come out. And we sat there and Roger looked at me and I looked at him and he thought, This is a bit odd. It's usually out before now, because what they do is they take the lamps and they just test against the seal, the old seal where the old roadway used to go down to the workings. They seal it off. So what they do is they go up with the miner's lamp with the flame on and they test for any leaks where this seal is, just to make sure it's not leaking. So we thought, it's been a long time in there. So after a couple of minutes, it was like, we're looking at each other and there. I hope he's not had a heart attack or anything. So we both got up and went to have a look, and there was nobody there. Now, the thing is, at the time, I wasn't scared. It was like, how can there be nobody here? You know, it wasn't a scary thing. And we'd both quite plainly seen him, because I questioned him after, what did you see? You know, and he said the same to me. And it was like, we'd both quite plainly seen him come towards us and then duck under the belt into the heading, like he was going to inspect the old seal. But when we got there, there's nobody there. Now, the thing is, down a mine, you can't hide, you can't go anywhere. He would have had to have come out past us to go anywhere else. So for him to hide or disappear, we would obviously have seen him, because he's surrounded by solid rock, or cold as the case may be. So that was very odd. And I have to say, Roger, afterwards he says, you better come and see me tomorrow. He said, I don't want to be here on my own. But
I can imagine.
Yeah, but it wasn't a frightening thing. He just looked like a normal person. But it was only retrospectively after the event that it was obvious that it wasn't, you know. So it wasn't particularly scary, that one. It was, but it was, what can I say? It was very obvious that it wasn't a living person, because you can't just disappear down a mine, because there's nowhere to disappear to.
Did you ever find out if there was somebody who died down there?
Well, we did ask. And the thing is that especially in the older mines as they were at the time, there were a lot of old workings where people will have died. But again, this is another thing. Was that a spirit of somebody that had died? Or was that, you know, like the ghost, the impression of them? Or was that just somebody visiting, remembering days when he was happy and we just happened to pick it up? I don't know.
Yeah, it could have been either one of those things. That is, it's interesting, because you do say that the people can leave an impression on the fabric of a building. Yeah. So, I mean, by that, you know, people can leave that impression down in a mine, I suppose.
Yeah. And another thing that happened to me down a mine, and it was the same mine, was that I had a premonition of an explosion. And again, it was something that to me at the time was real and scared me to death. And I thought I was going to die. We weren't near the end of the shift. And I was scared enough that I scared my mate and he came out with me. We both lost an hour's pay. Because when you work for the coal board in those days, there was no shirking. You were either working or you didn't get paid, end of story. So if you didn't turn up, you didn't get paid. And I scared him enough, because I thought I was going to be involved in an explosion, that I walked out and I scared him too, and he came out with me. So, but the following day, literally, I wouldn't say exactly 24 hours, probably about 30 hours afterwards, there was an explosion up in one of the mines near Newcastle. That was exactly sort of the sort of thing that I'd experienced. And 40 men, I don't think anybody died, but 40 men were injured. They were burned. And straight away, my father said, because I told him immediately when I came home, and he said, that is what you will have experienced. He says, that's what you've picked up on. And it was like, really? So it's weird that I've, in some ways, I feel like throughout life, I've been steered in certain directions. And then you have these experiences that are almost like examples of what is out there. You don't know about and you don't come across it in normal daily life, but this is there around you all the time. You're just not aware of it.
Yeah. And one of those such experiences was a monk that you saw. Tell me about that.
Ah, right. Well, that was it. It wasn't it, what it it was. I didn't see it, but I used to work nights as a bit of extra income, like you do, doing two or three jobs. And I used to help out at a local nightclub, just literally tidying up during the night, mopping the floors, putting everything back ready for the morning. And it was literally just a tidying up job. And I think it was a bit of security as well. But lots of people there had seen a monk. So everybody was like saying to me, "You're going to see this monk, or you'll be scared to death," and all the rest of it. But I never actually did. I never felt anything and I never saw anything. But looking at it again, retrospectively, the building itself was built from the stone of the old monks' cloisters. The same stone was used. So I just, again, trying to look at it logically, it's quite, logical that somebody's energy can be imprinted on the fabric of those stones, and that in certain circumstances, that's what people are picking up on.
Yeah, I have a monk story that might loosely tie in with what you're talking about, but it's a first-hand account. It happened in Ayr, which is where I'm from. It was back in the 60s, and it was a bakery boy, and he was on his way to work. It was about 4 a.m., and he, as just as he came up to the bit you'd cross the road to go down to the bakery, he saw a monk walk through the wall outside the old Blackfriars Monastery. And to me, that, you know, was the impression of the spirit of the monk. And that area has been known also to contain some restless spirits. So so that's a good little... Scary stories always seem to involve monks somehow.
Oh, well, there was... There was one where I was, I used to work at an ambulance station that's been demolished now. It's not there anymore. But it was built on an old path, if you like, an old road between villages. And like everything these days, it's all bulldozed and these new things and industrial estates built where they shouldn't be. But anyway, and we were in the ambulance station and like 3-4 o'clock in the morning. And again, I can go back to this, but we were all going to sort of trying to fall asleep and catching our sleep when one of the guys, there was a, like what you could say, ambulance officer's little office that had a nice comfy chair in, that he'd grabbed and had gone to sleep in the office. It wasn't locked or anything, but you could just go in and grab the comfy chair if you were there first. So he'd already come back earlier. As a later crew, we came back in. So we're in the main crew room. And then he comes marching in out of the office. And he went, "Did you see her?" And it was like, "What?" And he was absolutely, he was shaking, you know, he was wise and he was saying, "Why?" And he says, "I was just nodding." He says, "I'm just falling asleep. And a woman walked past me." And we went, "What?" And he said, "An old woman in a cowl carrying a bag." He says, "What's right past," he said, "literally right next to me, past the enemy chair, through the door and into the mess room where you were." And there were like three of us in there and I'm like, "Well, we didn't see anything." But he absolutely scared him to death. And he wouldn't go back in there on a night on his own. He made sure he stayed in the mess room with everybody else.
I can imagine that as well. Oh, that would have been quite frightening. Now, let's talk about how we perceive things with our own unique vibrations and frequencies. And you said that this can lead us to experience and witness paranormal events in quite different ways. So how so?
Right. Well, if you think about it, each one of us is unique. Each one of us has our own vibration, our own aura, our own energy, and that reacts to wherever you are and whoever you're with. So therefore, you will know automatically when you meet somebody and your aura is next to theirs, you know if you're going to get on with them. That's why we even use the right phrases. We even say they were on my wavelength, don't we? And so there's things like that. And one instance that I gave in the book where a good friend of mine was a paranormal group up in the Northeast. And he said, the three people all experienced something completely, well, not say completely different, but different. One saw an old soldier or an old person in uniform. One saw something and they thought it was an entity, if you like, or a spirit or something, but they couldn't identify anything. And another one just got a feeling that there was something there and saw like a bit of a shimmer, but didn't see anything physical. But afterwards, and these, they didn't communicate with each other. And it was afterwards, they used to just write down what they'd seen. And when they wrote down and they compared notes, and they sort of went back and they sort of, the conclusion from the group was, yes, this place could be haunted by a spirit from maybe the Second World War, something like that. Because obviously they'd done the historical research beforehand, so they knew what units had been there and when. But they obviously couldn't pinpoint, even though somebody had seen like a person in uniform, mm-hmm. not enough detail to be able to specifically identify them. And I think that partly when we see spirit or when you see UFOs, when you see cryptids, a lot of it can be down to how developed you are and whether you're on the right vibration, whether your frequency is just at the right frequency or energy to react with the energy that possesses at the time. Now, just one thing going on from this that makes it slightly more complicated, if you move into the field of ufology and UFOs, I believe that ET completely understands and can manipulate and can control all the energy that it needs to. That's how they move. That's how we see and experience what we do. And that is why people see things and others don't, because they can be selective. They can tune into certain things. And if they don't want you to remember it, you won't remember it. Because if, yeah, it's something else you have to think is each thought that you have is an energy. So that is why, going back to the beginning, what I said earlier, the way, it's not only the way that you cook, and I can get my teeth in, not only the way that you conduct yourself, it's also the way that you think. And this is partly where our sort of materialistic society has to get over this hurdle and has to be able to think of the way that they're moving and the way that the thoughts are, and try and be more spiritual and try and be more kind and all the rest of it. And that is why we see and hear, sort of experience different things, because we are all on different frequencies. We are all on different wavelengths. But ET knows that, but that's not quite the same when you're looking at cryptids and the paranormal.
I can actually think of two examples where that has happened. I remember talking to a UFO witness who said that he asked passers-by in the street if they could see what he was seeing, and they, you know, is there something up there? And they said yes, and they just walked on like it was something unremarkable, you know. And they were seeing this as a UFO, but the other people didn't seem, they could see there was a light in the sky, but they didn't seem to think it was anything particularly remarkable. But the second one is a mother and daughter that I read about, and the mother perceived what she saw as an angel, and the daughter perceived what she saw as a UFO.
Right.
So it's the perception, really. That's one thing. That's one aspect. And perhaps, as you say, it could be that whatever is able to control our perceptions.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that we, as any ufologist and people that investigate things, you will hear instances, and there'll be people where you've got witnesses that will say this, I mean, and this is true of cryptids and the paranormal as well, not just UFOs, but they'll say they became scared. And I have a good one where I have a nephew who was in the army. I was in the army, he was in the army. But he left the army, but what he does, he works on vessel protection in the Arabian Gulf. So he's like, I'm not going to say a mercenary, but he works for a government doing vessel protection. So if any of these pirates come out, he's like supposed to be one of the first on scene. So these vessels are run by the Navy. They run with no lights. They've got all these weapons and everything else just to make sure that the oil tankers, the cruise ships and everybody else have got the protection around them. And he said, Paul, the night sky is fantastic. He says, we can be in the middle of like the Indian Ocean or the Arabian Gulf and whatever. And he says, you can just see everything. So very often, he says, we just lay on the deck, just looking up at the sky because they run with no lights. And he said there was one night in particular where he saw this big, all he described it as was a big light. So it was a big light in the sky. But he said it was stationary and there was other smaller lights coming and going. He says the smaller ones were like the size of a star, where this was much bigger. And he says the thing was, we were sailing slowly towards it. So he says, we're there supposed to be big, roughy, toughy soldiers there to protect everybody else. And he says, and we're watching this. He says, and as we're getting closer and closer, he says, there were three of us on the deck. And he said, all three of us at the same time became scared. And he says, I've no explanation for it. He said, but without even talking to each other, we got up. He says, we went inside the ship. He says, and we sort of battened down the hatches. He says, and we never went out again. He said, we just went to sleep. And he says, again, retrospectively, we didn't talk about it to each other at the time, like, oh God, I'm not feeling, you know. It was like collectively, they all got up, went inside, closed the doors, and didn't go back out again. And this has also happened to my sister, who goes on holiday, rents one of these cottages every year. And this time they'd gone to somewhere in Wales and they'd been out for a meal for the night. They came back and they used to sit, if it was nice weather, they'd sit outside. If not, they'd stay inside and just have a game of cards. Then they all went to bed. And there was the three of them. And they saw these lights over the forest in mid Wales. And they said, as they saw these lights, they got the feeling that they shouldn't be watching them. He says, it wasn't exactly that I was scared of it, but it was like, I shouldn't be watching this. And instead of being, you would think logically and say, I need to be taking pictures of that and I need to be making notes. Well, she said, we just closed the curtains and knew that we shouldn't be looking at it, which was a very odd thing to say, really.
Yeah, it is very odd. I had a UFO experience and didn't, when I came back, I managed to get a photograph of it, but usually you would imagine coming in, I would immediately send that photograph to the group that I run, SPI Scotland, Strange Phenomena Investigations. It wasn't until a week later when I was looking through my photos and I went, oh yeah, why haven't I posted that up?
Yeah.
I mean, that's just
really,
really odd to do that.
Yeah. You know? One of the things that I said in my book, we had my wife's first sighting and there were five adults and two children, and one appeared, just blinked into existence, if you like, and there were five of us. Now we had five mobile phones, we had two iPads, and it never occurred to me at all to take any sort of picture, video, anything until after the event. And when it had gone and they were all going, oh yeah, wow, that were different, and then it was like, why didn't I take a picture? Mm-hmm. And I mean, I had binoculars and everything, and it was like, why didn't I take a picture? And I think they're able to sometimes, I'm not saying the same on the paranormal or cryptid side of things, but with UFOs, very often the witnesses get that connection. And there is this tenuous connection where they can influence what you do or do not do.
You gave a remarkable demonstration of healing abilities when you were quite young. What happened?
Well, you see, this is something else. I think we all have these innate abilities that we either discover or don't discover, as the case may be. And it was one of those where, for me, it was a perfect example of what we could be capable of. And I was just told to go. And I have to say, I had an ulterior motive where the lady in question had a very nice looking, a gorgeous daughter who I knew through school because we were both at high school together. So when this medium said to me, "I want you to go and see Betty." Hang on, let me just think about this. No, it wasn't. She said, "I want you to go and see Pearl." And straight away, as soon as she said Pearl, I thought, "Ooh, I know her daughter. Yeah, I'll go and see Pearl any day." And then she said, "Just go and see her and then come back and let me know." So, and then in those days, I mean, I was only a young teenager. I didn't have a car. We used to just get the local bus, and I knew where she lived, and it was just a few villages away. And I walked in the door, and I was greeted by Pearl, who was on her own. Her daughter wasn't there. She'd gone to grandma and granddad. But the house was in complete darkness. All the curtains closed, the doors closed, everything. And she just said, "Hi, Paul." And it was like somebody else took over my body. It was like I knew what to do. And it was weird because she opened the door, and I just followed her in, closed the door behind me. And she walked. She had one of these big, huge, old Victorian sort of terrace houses, a through terrace. And there was this big lounge with a fireplace. And in front of it, she'd put this big old carver chair. And she literally went and sat down and said a prayer. And I knew I just had to put my hand on her head. Now, I didn't really know this woman that well. I'd met her at church, and it was only because of the daughter going to school with the daughter that I knew. And I, then for whatever reason, as I said, it was like something took over my body. And I can still remember it now. I put my right hand up in the air, like towards the ceiling, and my left hand just above the top of the head. So I wasn't quite touching her. And then I felt this power, like somebody had turned an electrical current on, if you like. I could feel this energy, this vibration coming from somewhere up there, down through my arms and into the top of her head. And it literally only lasted a minute. It was obvious. You could feel the energy. You could feel the power. And then it just switched off. And when it switched off, I knew that was it. And I just took my hands down, put both my hands on her shoulders. To me then, she was probably... I'm saying now she's probably only in her late 40s, maybe 50 years old, but to me she was an old lady, somebody in the middle teens. And this old lady sort of turned towards me and just said, "Well, you hide your light under a bushel, don't you?" And she just stood up, opened the curtains, made a cup of tea, and then that was it. And I didn't, at the time, I didn't even know what happened. But it turned out she suffered from really debilitating migraines, where she'd be in the house in complete darkness for 2 or 3 days at a time. And I'd just gone in and literally in 1 minute had cleared it, and she went back to normal. Wow. And I didn't realise until afterwards. And one of the comments that I make afterwards, it was like I was given it was like the perfect example of what is possible. And I think going back to even to somebody like Jesus, that where they were able to recognise the energy when something's wrong and correct it.
Yeah. And did you carry on with doing healing?
No, I never, as I said, I only ever went to the church at mum's and dad's behest. It's like, "We're going to church, you're coming," type of thing, or this christening, or for the naming ceremony, for argument's sake. But that was the only time I went. I've never considered myself a religious person, really. And I don't know whether that's sort of a backlash from being made to do it when I was small. But it's something that had never interested me. And yes, I can see the good and I can see the bad side of it. So I can see that there are still wonderful people that work within religions, but there are also some not so wonderful people too.
Yeah, it's very true. But what a shame that, you know, you're a gifted healer and, the world is not getting to enjoy that.
Well, I don't know that I am. You see, again, it's like a lot of the things that that occur in your life. And for me, it was like being shown, just giving an example, this is how you can be. This is what we are all capable of.
Yeah. In your second chapter, you talk about frequencies that constantly influence our lives. Yeah. Tell me about that.
Well, if you think about it, everything is energy. We deal with just a really, really small part of it, and we're only aware of a really small part of it. If we look at our normal electromagnetic spectrum that we deal with on a daily basis, you've got the long, weaker and lower energy radio waves at one end, and then it comes up through the infrared to the visible and acoustic spectrum that we see and hear and deal with. And then it goes up through the ultraviolet, then X-rays, and then gamma rays, which are the shorter, higher energy waves at the other end. Now, that is ordinary matter that we know about and can explore, if you like. We're aware of it. We use radios, we use infrared, we know about the ultraviolet, we use X-rays, and then the higher energy with the gamma rays. We know about all that, not necessarily can control it, but the actual bit we deal with, the visible light and acoustic spectrum, is less than 0.1% of that energy, of that normal electromagnetic spectrum. Now, the other thing, that's just ordinary matter. More recently, we have these astrophysicists, these cosmologists, these people with far better brains than I, that now saying that the way that the universe is reacting and moving, and the, what can I say, the energy and the mass within the universe is acting to itself, that this dark matter and dark energy make up by far the greater part of the universe. And the latest estimates are something around the region of the ordinary matter that we deal with the radio waves at one end, through what we see to the gamma rays at the other, is only 5%. Dark matter is 35%, and dark energy is 60%. So we're only seeing 0.1% of the 5%. So there's all this other energy, and I liken it to, if you imagine going back to the LP and the single vinyl record, that's our electromagnetic spectrum that we're aware of. But there's a whole stack of records, and this is where the paranormal and ET, if you want to call it that for a coverall phrase, this is where they are all the time. And that's why spirit is around us all the time, and that's why ET is around us all the time. And it's not that they're on our frequency, on our LP, they're on their own frequency on another LP, if you like. And that is the difference we get with what I see, how we experience, that is why we experience what we do, why we see what we do, because ET, again, going back to what I said earlier, being complete masters of the whole of this matter and energy, are aware of it and can control it and can manipulate it, and that is why we see and hear what we do.
I think we just have time for you to tell us about your trip to Warminster with your uncle. What happened?
Yeah, well, I had an uncle. Going back to when I first saw this book, saw this UFO, you could not get books on UFOs. There was no internet then. There was no mobile phones. There was no sort of connections that we have nowadays. And what you had to do was literally catch the local bus, wherever it was, to the nearest city to even find a library that may have books on UFOs, or a bookstore that would order you a book on UFOs. So that's how I started my research that way. And I had an uncle who I found out later was a member of a group. And he turned up one day and you could tell I was still in my mid-teens, but how my dad ruled the roost, because he came to see my dad first and said, I'm going down to Warminster, can Paul come with me? And we had this little Reliant Regal, this little three-wheeler, and we drove from Yorkshire all the way down to Salisbury and down to Warminster. and we had a long weekend down there. But he was meeting this other group, and we met Arthur Shuttleworth, a few for the elder statesmen and women of the group still remember the Warminster thing and the big thing that was happening there, really, in the late 60s. And there were photographs of UFOs and a lot of paranormal activity going on. And Arthur Shuttleworth wrote quite a few books, and we were actually meeting at his house. Or I believe it was his house, and it was this little stone-coloured cottage, and we all sat and had tea in the garden. And then we had one night at Cradle Hill and one night at Clay Hill, just sky-watching. And we saw something both nights, but again, it was just lights in the sky. But one little thing, that a story that stuck with me, that Arthur was a great one for telling stories. And in the middle of the night, I was just stood talking to him, and he said, because I'd just been down to Salisbury Plains to the Stonehenge and taken a few photographs. And he said, I was down there not that long ago. And he said, I'd walked from the henge down to the Heelstone next to the road. And he said, I was stood looking at Stonehenge. He says, leaning against the Heelstone. He says, and as I put my head back, he says, it was quiet, middle of the night, I was on my own. And he said, as I put my head back, he said, this like musical note, and this blue light came up from the Heelstone and seemed to go up into the heavens. And it was like, wow, that was quite an admission. But again, if you just tuned and in the right place at the right times, and that is how mediums work, you know, it's how you interpret what you experience.
That sounds fabulous. I think I've got a photograph of me with my arms around the Heelstone one summer solstice morning that I was there.
Wonderful.
Yeah, it was. It did. Actually, I could feel something, and I didn't put much stock in things like that, you know. At that point, didn't get it, you know.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of these old places. There's obviously some up your neck of the woods. I mean, Castle Rigg coming back down further south, past where I am. But there's a lot of these that have a lot of energy, and we just understand it.
Yeah. I'll tell you, somewhere that I really felt it was the Clava Cairns up north near Inverness. It's where the Outlanders was filmed, you know, the bit where she goes through the stones. That was Clava Cairns. So that is definitely somewhere for people to visit if they're up in that area. Anyway, I have to say it's been fantastic talking to you, Paul, but unfortunately we are at the end of another exciting and fabulous ADX Files, and I'm just really grateful that you were able to make it onto the show, Paul, and talk to him about all this fabulous stuff that you've written in this book that you've written. Do you think there'll be any more books?
Well, this is it. It's like the today we haven't really touched much on the UFO side and how I explain how they work. So we'll let the listeners, that's what's in the book. It moves on into that, and it's just how I can explain how that works.
Yeah. Well, thank you again so much. And listeners, join me next month, I hope, for another exciting episode of ADX Files. Thank you very much.